Welcome to Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, pull it apart, and string the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staver. This season, we're untangling the housing crisis. We centered our first three episodes on why home prices keep going up. Then, in episode four, we looked at the price of everything else. Today, we're unraveling why, in nearly every state, white residents are more likely to be homeowners than Americans of color. Owning a home remains the heart of the American dream, but it's a dream that for a long time excluded non-white Americans. In the 30s and 40s, banks drew big red lines around minority communities, labeling them too risky for mortgages. Black families were shut out, and their descendants still haven't caught up. 44% of Black Americans are homeowners. For white families, that number is 74. And since homes are major sources of inheritance, the homeownership gap has created a racial wealth gap. And it's a gap that's been widening since the pandemic, especially here in Central Ohio. But before we untangle what's happening here at home, I want to travel north to Youngstown.
Youngstown is one of the top three most poverty cities in the state. It's concentrated poverty as well on top of that. We went through recession in the 80s, and we've never rebounded from that. And I mean manufacturing closed down here in the 80s, where for everyone else it sort of closed down much more recently, 2000s. And it's been really slow to come back.
That's Democratic Representative Lauren McNally. She lives in Youngstown with her husband and four children. When I asked her how she views generational wealth, she paused for several seconds before answering.
That's a really good question because it doesn't exist in my part of the state.
It sounds like the idea that the parents are going to cover the cost of college or the parents are going to shell out $15,000, $20,000 to help them get into their first house. That doesn't sound like it's a common story where you're from.
That is absolutely not a common story from around here. In fact, it's one of the reasons we fought really, really hard to get a community college here, unfortunately, only to see it recently fold. And now people are really scared about accessibility to higher education because these are the idea of affording a traditional four-year college was never within reach.
The same is true here in Central Ohio. Black families are less likely to be homeowners, and the homes they do own are usually of lesser value. But there's a local group working to counter this. It's called Homeport. Linda Evans is the CEO, and she joins us now. Welcome to Untangled, Linda.
Good morning.
Good morning. So the gap between Black and white homeownership is larger today here in Columbus than it was in the 1960s. And I'll admit that when I saw that statistic on your website, I had to stop and read it again. How is it worse today than the year that the Fair Housing Act passed?
Good question, Anna. And Homeport, we are a locally based private nonprofit. We've been in existence for about 37 years, and we've been tackling this with a group, a coalition, called Convergence Columbus. And it's fair housing specialists, financial institutions, government leaders, nonprofit partners. We're all at the table discussing this exact topic. And one of the things that the data will tell you is that the practices that were being done in the 40s, 50s, 60s, redlining, blockbusting, restrictive covenants, all those things still have the generational impacts. We're not far enough removed from those actions to have seen a turn in the amount of African-American and minority home ownership. So think about how many houses, how many times have that house been sold since that time? One, two, three, maybe. We're still not seeing that turn then impact African-American home buyers in particular, which is why Convergence was established, was to address the widening gap. Columbus is one of the leading cities in our state, in our country, unfortunately, in the gap between African-American and white home ownership. And that's why the group was put together.
one of the major barriers that you identify is coming up with that initial down payment, that 3 to 5% to get you into that first home. Mm-hmm. So you had this great statistic that it takes about 11 years for a typical Black renter to save, 14 mm-hmm. years for a Hispanic household, and that's quite a bit longer than it takes the average white family. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, and I think back to your point about generational, oftentimes you'll see white home buyers receive assistance from family, friends, or from, you know, equity that has been built in that previous first generation homeowner. And if you don't have that, where does that kind of cash resource come from to be able to put down on a new home? You see that with Black home buyers, only about 10% of the time will they have that kind of assistance from family members. So again, if you look across the spectrum, it's an income disparity, but what it results in, again, is an inability to move up that economic ladder and have the same access to opportunities when you're trying to save and it takes 11 years or 14 years compared to 3 or 5 years. You just see white home buyers being able to enter the market sooner, earlier in their lives at different points. Maybe, again, start with a starter home and then move up to a larger home that has more value. While, again, 11, 14 years are passed by and families are still trying to get inside that initial home. So you're creating that that starting line is further away for many of the Black and brown home buyers that we're talking about.
Do you think some of that is also just that legacy of redlining? Because mm-hmm. if your parents aren't homeowners, they may not have that equity to give you exactly. towards your house.
Exactly. So again, it becomes not just your generation's problem, but the next generation. So we talk about this cyclical nature of home buying. And even if you're, if we talk about there's a knowledge gap, a knowledge basis that when you have bought a home, then you can share that information with your children or your nephews and nieces and things like, but if you don't have that even within your family structure, within your family, immediate family, who do you go to? Who do you trust? Who do you talk to about the home buying process? Where do you get that information? Where do you find out about resources? And that knowledge gap along with that financial gap then again leads to those delays in ownership that we see with Black and brown buyers.
And that's something that Homeport is working on with Convergence Columbus. You guys created mm-hmm. a new fund in February. Tell us about yes. what that offers first-time homebuyers.
Yeah, so it's been very exciting. This is the first of its kind in our region. The Maud Hill Growing Home Ownership Fund is a direct response to the research we just talked about. It's directly targeting closing those home ownership gaps that we see, one of which is resources, having the dollars to put down on a home. And so it's a $1 million fund. It's, you know, funded by numerous partners, including City of Columbus. Many of our banking partners are at the table, as well as, you know, private donations and grants that we've gotten to do this fund. We're expecting to help somewhere between 50 and 60 home buyers. About $15,000 will be available. It is specifically to address the gaps that we see in home buyers coming to resources. And then one of the great things is it lets buyers buy throughout Franklin County. So it's not limited to City of Columbus or any one jurisdiction. It's throughout Franklin County where we see people are buying across the spectrum. That could be City of Columbus, it could be Reynoldsburg, it could be Westerville, it can be anywhere in the geography. And we think that that's really going to help us access more buyers and serve more of the market through this fund.
And how does someone go about applying for that?
Oh, yes. Big question. We're getting applications every day. Of course, we've announced the fund on February 1st. It has great absorption. We work closely with not only the peers and partners in Convergence, but also the Columbus Realtors, the Columbus Realtors, the Mortgage Bankers Association. We're talking to any and everybody. If you are a buyer, we want you to reach out. You can reach out directly to us. You can start with your realtor. You can start with your lender, or you can come through bloom614.org, which was designed again by the Convergence Group to really be a journey map for home buyers. If you aren't sure where you're at in the process, if you're not sure where to start, this website is going to help you along the way with support, guidance, and transparency for every step of the home buying process. So any of those ways you can get to us. The message that we definitely want to share is that it's possible. We know, I think you mentioned in some of your other conversations, you've been talking about why our prices keep going up. Why is our supply so suppressed? Why can't we serve more of the market? And so that's very discouraging. Interest rates went up and then houses went up. away at the same time. And that's very discouraging to many buyers. But the home buying process has always been a journey. It takes work, but we're here to stand with them and move people through that process if they want to.
Can I ask, you know, we're going to further into this hour, we're going to dive into the history of redlining, how it was developed, how it was perpetuated. But how does it manifest itself in housing around the city today?
Mm-hmm. So what you see still in our market is segregation amongst people. So you see certain neighborhoods where you'll have higher percentage of minority owners, or you'll see certain neighborhoods where you have less integration. And I think that that's one of the things, some of the legacies of redlining that you'll see still today. Also with that is you see disinvested neighborhoods. So some of our legacy neighborhoods, you think of neighborhoods like Linden, like the Near East Side, Hilltop, areas that have you seen less investment in, and you don't see that resurgence in the market. It's come together through private and public partnerships that are really investing in those areas and valuing the assets that those areas hold. But we can see that that legacy of redlining did depress those markets and the houses values in those markets for many, many, many years. And now we're starting to see some of that resurgence because of the dampening in our supply. We're starting to see some of those values come back up.
I want to ask you about something that I read in preparation for this that really stopped me in my tracks, and I want to get your take on it. So as recently as 2023, The Washington Post wrote an article about ongoing racial bias in appraisals. Mm-hmm. And there was this quote that just, I had to stop. And it's from a woman named Miss Horton, who is going through a reappraisal process. And she's Black. And she gets this appraisal that's way lower. And then she has her husband is white. And so she has him go and sit for the next appraisal. And she says, "My heart kind of broke. I know what the issue was. And I knew what we needed to do to fix it, because in the Black community, it's just common knowledge that you take your pictures down when you're selling the house. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think I had to worry about it with an appraisal." And yeah. I just, that even to this day, we are still seeing appraisers who control, like, they have parameters, but they have a lot of discretion in what they set the value of a house at.
Mm-hmm. I think you see the same thing, and not to get off of your point, but I think you see the same thing even in that Black mortgage applicants are denied at twice the rate of white applicants. And so I think we see those individual biases still show up in these processes that we think are pretty, you know, subjective. Seem pretty objective. We think that they have a process. They have, you know, parameters that they're working within, but some of those things are still subject to those biases that can creep into the process. They may not even be individual. They may be built into the process for how you value a house or how you, you know, evaluate an applicant. And those are the things that we are continuing to work against and try to get under in order to have a system that really supports more broad-based ownership, supports more broad-based appraised values, which supports more applicants being approved for credit. But it is, I think, deeply systemic in that way that, again, like you said, the Miss Horton, she knew what the problem was, and she didn't want to know that, she didn't want to see the result, but the result confirmed what she knew what the problem was. And then that's also just inherently how we evaluate neighborhoods, that we've decided some places are good, some places are bad. And I think that again, place doesn't have a characteristic in that way, but we've decided that in some ways too, that those, oh, that's not a neighborhood you want to live in, or that's not a school district you want to be in. And some of those things, again, bleed into that valuation process. And as we said, so often those neighborhoods have a higher percentage of persons of color. And so how do we disconnect those two things, that there are places that are good, there may be a reason yet you want to live in a neighborhood that, you know, is more densely developed, right? Like this is part, bleeds into some of our conversations about density. There's a reason you want to live in a more densely urban neighborhood. And maybe there's a reason you want to live in a more traditional suburban looking neighborhood. Those are choices. They're not good or bad in that way. And I think that's some of the things that we got to continue to work against.
So what should the city of Columbus, Franklin County, or even the state be doing to help correct this issue?
I think we're moving in the right direction. Obviously, we're ever hopeful. We're a nonprofit that's trying to solve the problems of the community, right? So we're ever hopeful. This fund is a tremendous step forward in saying that we use data-informed process to come up with this strategy, right? And we see a gap. Here's how we're going to fund this gap. are we going to be able to move the needle? So we're going to be evaluating this, this program works and how it's being absorbed in the community, and being able to come back and say, here's how many, you know, persons went into home ownership. Here's where, here's how it affected the community. And that's the work that you see still going on at the state level. They've established a new down payment, a fund that you can help you save for buying a home, similar to the 529 educational account. So account that lets you help save to buy a home. We have a new state credit for home ownership housing development. That's new. That hasn't been done before. So I do think we're having the right conversations in the right time. One of the things that is a challenge is that things are just costing more. Then there's no more land. So we do have to keep thinking about the zoning and how do we create housing in more dense ways? How do we develop in ways that serve the market today, not just the market we've historically had? And how do we bring more ownership opportunities to the plate? But the city, obviously, again, is updating the zoning code. The county and the city both investing in funds like this. And then again, I think our state legislators are doing the right work and asking the right questions. It's not going to be one tool that solves all of the issues that we're discussing. It's going to take all of these things working on all fronts to move it forward. And then as you referenced earlier, we still have to still continue to look at the systemic issues that perpetuate the challenges that we're trying to address so that we don't find ourselves always solving the same problem.
Yeah, because, you know, $15,000, it's a huge leg up for somebody, but it... Mm-hmm. You know, it's starting to teeter on the edge of being enough to qualify somebody for the average house here in Columbus. And as home prices go up, that's only going to continue.
For sure. So I think that we can't discount this program from the work that needs to be done to increase the supply, right? Like these things can't happen separately, or the work that, you know, needs to happen to, you know, update our zoning across the board. That's not just the city of Columbus challenge, that's across our region. How do we be a community that says yes to housing and has housing in all the places that people want to live? And so I think we can't think of these as separate. They have to be in tandem with each other. And part of that is our wide conversation with the community about housing and density and where housing goes and where housing should be, and bringing more people to the table to say, yes, I'm okay with more neighbors. Yes, I'm okay with that site that used to be, you know, one house now being three maybe, right? And those kind of changes that we see coming for our region. As we said, we've been preparing for the growth in our region for, you know, more than a decade. We knew this growth was coming. Did it come, you know, and sooner than we thought? Yes, but we knew this growth was coming and we have strategies and plans. We just all have to continue to grow in the same direction to make them come together.
That was Leah Evans, President and CEO of Homeport. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, we're expanding our view from what's going on in Ohio to what's happening in the country at large. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Anna Staber. We're untangling the housing crisis this season, and today's show is about generational wealth and the racial gap in home ownership. Because America has made major strides towards racial equality over the last 100 years. We banned racial discrimination in employment, banking, education, elected our first Black president, appointed Supreme Court justices from all different races and genders. And yet, the disparities in family wealth remain. Here to help us understand the scope of the problem is Chuck Collins. He's director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Untangled, Chuck.
Hi, Anna. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So the wealth gap between Black and white Americans is startling, but it seems to make more sense to me now that we've done this series, because housing is such a core component of how we build and pass on wealth.
Very much. It's where sort of the racial wealth or where discrimination kind of is built into the architecture or the landscape over generations. And I can say as a white person with grandparents in Ohio, I remember my uncle buying his farm after World War II for a with a farmer's home loan, 1%, 40 years fixed rate. I think he paid $80 a month and bought a farm. That made it possible for the next generation and the next generation in our family to also buy homes. So you can sort of see how advantage works over generations as well as disadvantage.
In January, the Federal Reserve released its latest survey of consumer finances. And this is a big, like hundreds of thousands of data points, really big survey. And it found that Black wealth is increasing, but so is the racial wealth gap. And I was like, oh, okay, what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, one way to think of it is I call it the new physics of inequality, the compounding advantage for those who have advantage or already have wealth, and sort of compounding barriers. So it's true that the racial wealth divide has gone up or has narrowed slightly, although to put it in perspective, it hasn't, over since 1960. If we continued at the current rate of trying to close the gap, it would take about 500 years to close the racial wealth divide if white wealth stayed the same. So we should celebrate when gaps narrow, but understand this is what systemic inequality looks like. It just keeps growing.
Yeah, according to that survey of consumer finances, for every $100 in wealth held by white households, Black households held $15. And the total wealth difference between the two average households was $240,000. And to me, that sounds like a house.
It really is a house, and the I kind of think it's and I think Leah Evans kind of set the stage talking about the history. But after World War II, the white home ownership rate was about 44%, which is kind of where the Black home ownership rate is today. What was different is that we as a society invested tens of billions, who knows, trillions of dollars in helping build a white middle class, getting white households on the wealth building train, if you will, whereas Black
GI
and Latino
bills,
households,
loans, all kinds of things.
the low interest fixed loan that my great uncle got, those were all subsidies, if you will, that helped move the home ownership rate from under 50% for white households to where, as you said this morning, 75%. That wasn't an accident. That was through decades of commitments and investments. And so this is where that legacy of discrimination continues to show up in our communities and in our bank accounts, if you will.
Yeah, there's this line chart that I saw showing the increase in total wealth for different races since 1989. And I don't know if it's a good idea to try to use like audio to describe a actual chart, but the lines were moving left to right across the page, and they were colored in, so it looked like a mountain with different layers of rock. And so all the layers got fatter as you went from 1989 to present. But the layer for white families basically went from a bunny slope to a black diamond. It just like took off. So everybody went up, but for white home ownership, it just, or white wealth, it just shot right up. And I can't quite like I, it's one thing for the gap to stay the same, but I can't quite figure out what's causing that big jump upwards.
I mean, part of it is the last 40 years has been a period of not just the racial wealth divide, I would say, has been sort of supercharged by overall inequality trends. So there's still a white working class that's been left behind. There are white folks who can't purchase a home in today's economy as well. The gap overall grew, and it's sort of supercharged the racial wealth gap, making it wider too. So the white affluent and wealthy households really saw their assets accelerate and grow. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but I would simply summarize it as the rules of the economy have been good for white wealth owners, at the expense of everybody else. It's just tax policy, trade policy, what government spends money on or doesn't spend money on. All of that has boosted the assets of the top 10%, 1% of households.
Oh, so this is like when you look at the top 10% of households, there's that same like severe black diamond going from 10% to the top 1%.
Yeah, so it's hard to realize, you know, like, okay, yeah, most of the income and wealth gains of the last 40 years have gone to the top 10%. But within that, the top 1%, the top 1/10 of 1% have been the big gainers. And this actually affects housing, because one of the trends is there's more wealth moving into investing in the forms of housing that are kind of driving up land and housing costs. I could say more about that, but
yeah,
you know,
go ahead.
I would say there are these sort of the four invisible disruptive forces in our community that are the result of concentrated wealth in fewer hands. One is just old-fashioned gentrification. Wealthy people are able to bid up the cost of land and housing, and working people can't keep up with that. There's this phenomenon, though, of corporate investment or big private equity funds or basically pools of wealth moving into the housing market, buying up single-family homes in some markets, fueling short-term rentals. Again, not mom and pop with an Airbnb or someone with an extra bedroom, but
corporate Airbnbs.
Sort of corporate Airbnbs. And then global wealth coming to the United States. Global billionaires who are saying, wow, we want a stable place to park a lot of our wealth. What could be better than the Canadian or U.S. real estate market? So in a lot of our communities, we're seeing these disruptions because of this warped, imbalanced concentration of wealth.
I want to bring it back to Representative Lauren McNally. We heard from her at the beginning of the show, and she represents one of the poorest cities here in Ohio.
So you can look at Youngstown because it's more minority population than white population. It's right there. It's like 50. It might actually be a little bit higher than 50-50. It might skew one way or the other, but it's really close to 50-50. And 20% of all owner-occupied households in Youngstown are cost-burdened. 20%. 10% are severely cost-burdened, which means they're paying more than 50% of their income towards their housing. Those numbers are incredibly high compared to the state average. They're even significantly high compared to Northeast Ohio average numbers. And so you can say that we have real burdens for the minority population to become homeowners in the state of Ohio just based on that alone. Now, you put that on top of the fact that only 10% of mortgages are originating in the city of Youngstown. Those are alarming statistics.
And so she's sort of talking here about the inverse of generational wealth.
Yeah, that, you know, these are folks, and it's unfortunately a growing number of people, who I would say are just locked into rental housing. The whole idea that someday you'll be able to purchase a home is harder and out of reach. And part of that, as the legislator says, people are paying 40, 50% of their income for their rental housing. So they're not able to save money. They're sort of stuck in rental housing. And that's where, again, these, I would call them sort of predatory investors have come in and say, well, because this whole segment of the market is never going to buy a house, we're going to buy up single family homes and rent them to people as a way to make money off the fact that people can't get into home ownership. So it sort of locks people into that cycle of lack of ownership.
So has the government tried to do anything to address the way this is impacting housing?
Well, we kind of have a vacuum. We have had a long-term vacuum at the federal level. Again, you know, after World War II, for 30 years, we as a society made all these investments in public housing, rental housing, nonprofit and for-profit owned rental housing.
Even incentivizing those little tiny starter houses.
Yeah, first-time homebuyer loans. States like Ohio have tried to hang in there, and cities have sometimes done things to like, but so we're kind of suffering from the fact that there is no national housing policy, that the federal government used to make big investments when and helped a lot of people, mostly people of white heritage, get access to stable housing. So we're starting to see more people looking at, well, what should we do about short-term rentals? Short-term rentals, corporate short-term rentals are removing rental housing from the market. Or should we be concerned about so much investor motivation in these spheres? Can we tamp down or discourage the sort of wealth extraction pump from affecting our communities? Can we? And I think that the work that Homeport and Leah Evans and others does is so important because they're essentially carving out a space between the out-of-reach stable housing and the for-profit market. We basically have this problem, which is housing is both a economic engine, it's a commodity, and it's a basic need. And so we need more space for people who are not wealthy to have decent, affordable housing and not have to compete in this escalating market for this basic need.
Yeah, you can kind of draw the through line of we incentivized home ownership, made it cheap and easy, and a lot of those families then were able to give houses to their children, which let them buy houses, or they could give donation down payments to their children or cover college for their children. Like it had this like snowball effect that we're seeing now in the divide in housing.
Yeah, I think I sort of joke among my peers that those of us from white families who had parents who owned their own homes were beneficiaries of the Parental Down Payment Assistance Program, meaning our families helped us. And in fact, in a lot of markets, young people, I'm talking about people under 40, let's say, are unable to purchase a home unless they have family help.
I'm so
And
glad
so
you put
they're.
people under 40 as young.
Yeah, well, I'm saying even I'm thinking about even my own children who don't own homes and are sort of, in that sort of demographic. And we're even in those markets, our parental assistance isn't enough to help them. But, that's where if you are from an African American family and you didn't have access, your parents didn't own a home and your grandparents didn't own a home, then that intergenerational wealth isn't there to help the next generation get into the market. And that is a one of the dirty little secrets in the real estate market, I think, is nobody's doing it on their own. Anybody who's buying in certain markets is probably either they have a really amazing high-tech job and they earn $1 million a year, or they're getting family help.
And it's uncomfortable, but I do think it's important for me to be honest here for a moment because I think sometimes we look at people our age who buy houses and sort of wonder, how did they do that? And so in the interest of transparency, my parents gave us the down payment for our first house. And I know six other couples right off the top of my head that that's true for. And that spiraled. Now 9 years later, we have a ton of equity. And like we bought our second house with that equity. We bought our third house that we're living in now with that equity. Like that small seed at the beginning, and it was small because our first house was like 150,000, but that small seed at the beginning like has grown into an amazing amount of like family wealth for my family.
I'm glad you said that because I think it's important to demystify the reality and for more people to just say, hey, yeah, I got help. And for people who don't have intergenerational wealth, and we're not talking about substantial wealth,
No, it was
for
under
many people, it's,
$10,000.
yeah,
Yeah.
but
I
those
mean, still big
small,
money, but not like astronomical.
but those are, those make all the difference, though, in those. In certain housing markets, or it's the difference between buying a house that's sort of been milked and is running down, and you're kind of having to pay like a bad car, you just keep putting money into it, versus buying a car in a neighborhood where that might increase in value. And again, there's a racial dimension to that sometimes. So just being honest, and then it helps inform legislative conversation. Look like, well, okay, if you don't have family access to family wealth and assets, can society, can government create first-time home buyer loan funds, pools, short, second mortgage pools that are forgiven when somebody or sort of lives with the house till it sells? There's things we can do, as we did after World War II for 30 years. to put a lot of people into housing, stable and affordable housing and home ownership.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're untangling the why a racial gap in home ownership exists, and the role realtors and HOAs played in creating it. That's when Untangled continues.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling the housing crisis this season, and today's show is about both generational wealth and the persistent racial gap in home ownership. We've spent the first part of our hour getting a sense of what the extent of the problem is, both here in Ohio and across the country. Now I want to pivot to the why. Why are Black Americans less likely to be homeowners? What got in their way? For answers, we're turning to Gene Slater. He's a national housing finance expert and the author of Freedom to Discriminate: How Realtors Conspired to Segregate Housing and Divide America. Welcome back, Gene.
Hi.
Take us back to the 1930s. The government wants to incentivize home ownership, but it wants to draw really clear lines about where it's going to make investments.
I think to understand what happened in the 30s, I have to go back a little further. Starting in the beginning of the 1900s, American cities were not racially segregated. Neighborhoods were not racially restricted. The early real estate boards and their leaders in Berkeley and Kansas City were doing high-end communities, which they put covenants on. You have to keep the street trees and the minimum size of house. And they added to that the use of racial covenants, restrictive covenants, discriminating on the basis of race. That quickly spread from high-end subdivisions to middle class subdivisions to lower class subdivisions. And by the end of the 1920s, like more than half the homes in the country had restrictions and virtually all new subdivisions. So they were white only.
So this is the birth of the HOA.
Yes, the first homeowners association was created in Kansas City at Country Club Estates to enforce these racial covenants. That's what was its purpose. So along comes the 1930s and the Depression, and the Roosevelt administration decides to create the Federal Housing Administration to make it possible to be homeowners with long-term amortizing mortgages. The people they bring in to design this program, to head the staff, and effectively to operate it are the same realty boards. It's realtor members who design the first of the maps, which today we call redlining maps. But in the 1930s until the 1940s, they were secret. They were entirely secret. Nobody saw them other than FHA, developers, lenders. And those redlining maps, which distinguished those areas in which you could get a loan, were basically excluded areas where minorities lived. It wasn't just Blacks, it also included Jews, Italians, Greeks, Russians. After World War II, other groups got considered by the realtors as white and got let into these neighborhoods. So the people left behind in the areas where you couldn't get mortgages were Black Americans. And those neighborhoods, because all the money was going with 100% federal guarantees, was going in to the new neighborhoods, the new suburbs that were racially restricted. There was no money available in the Depression for these older neighborhoods where Blacks were forced to live. And so you wound up with a cycle of disinvestment and preventing Black Americans from using FHA and VA to buy homes.
So the realtors go in essentially and they help the new housing agency draw these maps. And they're not saying, you know, minorities live here, but they're basically saying these places where minorities live, these are not good investments. So it's saying it without saying it, essentially.
Maybe.
Yeah, or maybe it's more explicit.
It was pretty explicit.
Yeah.
And internally.
And so the places that get these new loans and the places that get these new investments and where things grow just happen to be the places that also have these covenants that say you can't sell a home to a person of color.
It didn't just happen. That was a requirement of FHA. You had to show that to develop a new area that it was so far remotely removed from where minorities might live.
Oh, my goodness.
And had racial covenants. These were the requirements. So it wasn't just happened. This was deliberate.
I want to take us forward to 1948 because I found this part to be so surprising that a group of realtors even proposed overturning the 14th Amendment. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. In 1948, the Supreme Court basically said that courts cannot enforce racial covenants because that's state action and you can't have discriminatory state action. And this was a, you know, enormous potential change in the country. So the realtors in California, in Los Angeles, proposed a national constitutional amendment that would say, exclude from the 14th Amendment the idea of racial covenants and propose specifically racial apartheid. This is the same year as and formally by government. And this was the same year as apartheid in South Africa. But on the advice of their lawyers, the realtors nationally dropped this amendment, stopped pursuing this amendment. Instead, we're told you can do the same things just by racial steering, by not taking calls from Blacks, by not showing them homes, telling them the home was already, you know, has already been sold. You can do it more subtly and quietly. And in fact, this became so powerful during the 1950s, the segregation against Blacks intensified. And, you know, by 1960, Black Americans were excluded from 95% of the neighborhoods in the United States.
They also moved to change things like zoning and city planning to make it harder for houses, say, that to be built in these areas.
Yeah, actually, the first single-family zoning in America was in Berkeley, California, of all places, because Duncan McDuffie, who had created the first racial covenants, he chaired and created the planning board and was a leader nationally in the city planning and zoning movement. He created the first single family zoning to prevent a Black dance hall from being built down the street from his subdivision. He could control his subdivision, but he needed zoning to protect the areas around it. So that's how zoning in America happened. And in fact, in the 1920, until 1920 or so, American cities, just grew larger and larger because they provided water and sewer. Starting in the 1920s, as part of this effort by realtors to have local planning control of what could happen, for the same purposes, they've created new fragmented suburbs. So the whole system of hundreds of separate local governments in each metropolitan area came out of this same thing, whose constituents naturally want to maintain the basis on which they had been sold their homes, namely Blacks can't live here.
I want to jump forward again in time to 1964. We're still in California, and the civil rights movement is picking up steam. And there's a realtor who comes up with a property owner's bill of rights. And this is fascinating to me because it sort of kicks off this idea of personal freedom that we understand now and debate now as a society.
Right. So starting in the late 50s, there was a small movement toward creating fair housing laws, because despite Shelley versus Kramer, obviously you couldn't buy homes. And the state legislature in California narrowly passed a fairly mild fair housing law, one which was limited to large rental properties and to about a quarter of all single family homes, those that had government insurance. In response to this, in some states, in Colorado and Massachusetts, the realtor board said, okay, we'll cooperate with this. But in California and most of the other parts of the country, they decided they would fight back against such laws and proposals. There was big battles in Ohio, in Michigan, in Illinois. But the biggest of all was in California, which had half the realtors in the country. And they proposed a state constitutional amendment. Think back about constitutional amendments here. They proposed a state constitutional amendment, which would say no government, no city, no county, not the state, could prohibit discrimination by owners of properties. You were free to discriminate.
So property rights were absolute.
Yes. And this absolute right, which nobody had ever talked about before, like the right of an owner to decide which of the people who offer the full price, they're not going to allow, you know, a Black family to buy that home, even if they offer the asking price. And to run this campaign, this is required, you know, a majority of voters in California, at the height of the civil rights movement, height of liberalism in the United States, when Johnson defeated Gore 60% to 40%, they were standing alone. The Chamber of Commerce wouldn't support them. All the church leaders were against them. All saw this as, you know, reactionary, trying to reinstate segregation. And so they needed an argument that could be effective. And the argument they came up with, it was emblazoned on freeway billboards around Los Angeles, was freedom of choice. This is your, and they defined this, the freedom, American freedom specifically, and the purpose of the revolution to create American freedom was not that all men are created equal or that all should have equal freedom, but was precisely to say, your freedom to discriminate. And they said, this is available to minority families too. They can discriminate. So this is, you know, we believe in equal rights. And this argument proved so powerful because it let people say, well, I'm not a racist. I'm not discriminatory myself. I just believe in what they called it, freedom of conscience. And they likened this to religious freedom. The conservative version of freedom is your absolute right without regard to the rights of others, rather than freedom being inclusive and is about equal freedom for all. This came out of that campaign and has dominated American politics ever since.
I will say that in November of 2020, the National Association of Realtors apologized for its racial steering practices and its opposition to the 1968 Fair Housing Act. But in the final moments that we have, I want to ask you, what is the lasting legacy of all this history? How should we be thinking about it today?
Well, this legacy compounded on itself because Blacks weren't, even after fair housing in 1968, right after Martin Luther King died, fair housing was weakened tremendously in Congress and it's never had an administrative enforcement method. Precisely because congressmen left and right saw the handwriting in the wall of this California vote, 65%, 80% of white votes for Proposition 14. So it's compounded itself in lack of wealth as prices have only gotten higher. It's still exists in informal ways with appraisers and lenders. Lenders turn down blacks with the same credit score as twice the rate of whites. But let me, so we only have a couple of minutes left. Let me just mention a couple of things that I think can be done. I'm often asked this, what can people do about this? One way is if realtors, lenders, appraisers lost their licenses, their state licenses as a penalty, that would have an impact on discrimination.
That was
many.
I'm so sorry. We have run out of the hour here, but okay. Thank you so much. That was Jean Slater, a national housing finance expert, and that'll do it for the fifth episode of Untangled. Thanks for listening to 89.7 WOSU.